Thank you very much. I want to thank my friend Dr. Sebu Haslanyan for this kind introduction and for the privilege of talking here. And I want to thank you all for coming. Now, in the first decades of the 9th century, in the village of Tondrak in southeast Armenia, a man named Sambat founded a religious heretical movement, which after its birthplace came to be called Tondrakian. And I want to briefly mention that when I use the word heretical or extremist, I use them with quotation marks. This movement rejected the main tenets of the Christian church and was opposed by the Armenian clergy and the Armenian and Muslim landowning elite alike. In fact, Sambat himself was killed by the Qaisi Muslim Amir Abulwart around 830 or 840. Despite the persecutions, the movement spread in several regions of Armenia and found followers among small landowners and clergy, as well as peasants and the poor. In the 10th century, the ruler of Vaspurakan and Taron, Gregory Magistros, suppressed it but did not succeed in fully eradicating the Tondrakians, and we find allusions to them centuries later in the works of 12th century Armenian authors Paul of Taron and Nersesh Nurhali. The Tondrakians have been studied by several scholars who proposed explanations as to their social nature and the influences of earlier Christian heresies in its doctrines. Several Soviet Armenian historians, in keeping with Soviet Marxist historiography, have viewed the movement as a struggle for class equality, indeed as a revolutionary opposition, while also presenting it as the Armenian national war against foreign oppressors. Nina Garsoyan has viewed them as a continuation of the Paulician heresy that emerged on the territory of Armenia a century earlier. And perhaps the most comprehensive work on the Tondrakians is Vrej Nersesyan's book, which presents a more nuanced and multifaceted view of them. According to him, far from being a purely national liberation movement against foreign oppressors, this movement combined elements of social protest with those of a spiritual quest. Today I will look at the Tondrakians from a different angle. I will present the movement within the broader picture of heterodox movements of late antique Near East, with an inventory of religious symbols and ideas that was shared across the boundaries of established religious denominations. In particular, I will note the similarities and the possible connections of the Tondrakian movement with several Islamic heretical currents that had been simmering in the territory of Iraq during the 8th and 9th centuries, occasionally bursting into broad view through rebellions and secretly producing a hitherto unknown vast body of literature. The connections that I will discuss are based on several doctrinal points shared by said Armenian and Muslim heretics, but my aim is not to propose one-sided or mutual influences. Rather, by noting the political, economic, and cultural connections of medieval Armenia with the larger Near East, I want to argue for a shared cultural religious environment where both Muslim and Christian heretics would use a common inventory of symbols and a shared religious vocabulary. Now, the possible connections between the Armenian heretics and some Muslim heresies have been noted by Nersesyan, who dismissed the idea, tracing their teachings back to the Gnostics. They were also briefly discussed by Seda Dadoyan, who, following Armenian historian Leo, notes in passing possible affinities between the teachings of the founder of Tondrakians, Sambat, and the Khorami rebel leader Babak. She does not, however, elaborate on the nature of these connections and on their outcome. In what follows, I will take a broader view, and rather than looking for connections between individuals, we'll look for connections between regions and population, from Armenia to Iraq to Khorasan. For the almost simultaneous emergence of heretical movements with a similar set of teachings on this entire territory is highly suggestive of a common religious milieu and of a migration of ideas as well as men on this territory. Unlike the Tondrakians, who have been studied rather extensively, the teachings of the Muslim heretics in question have been to this day known from outsider accounts, which are skewed and biased. In the last decade, a number of their original writings produced contemporaneously with or in the century preceding the Tondrakians began to come to light, allowing for a more accurate reconstruction of their beliefs. One of my goals, therefore, is also to highlight the importance of this little-known heritage of Muslim heretics for understanding the religious dynamics in the region at large. Nothing has survived of the original writings by Tondrakan authors, and the main accounts about them are by Armenian church figures. One of the most comprehensive lists of their teachings is by Gregory of Narek, Grigor Narekatsi, who mentions the following 14 points. They deny ordination, communion of his body, birth through spiritual throes of the water and spirit, which brings forth children to God. He had taught them to be nothing but bathwater. They deny the blessed Lord's day, genuflection, and mysterious prayer, the fount in which Christ himself was baptized, and the communion of immortality. And they preach the filthy habit of lecherous promiscuity. Again, they deny the venerated sign, that is the cross. They preach their anthropolatrous apostasy, in Nersesian's translation, Martabash Duratsutunen, their self-conferred contemptible priesthood, their deprecation of the sacrament of marriage, their railing and caviling at the first fruits, that is the sacrifice of Matach, and they dare to call the head of their abominable sect Christ. And Nerses Shnorhali says that the body of our Lord was not of human nature, but existed before the creation of men in eternity in its divinity. Ultimately, all these points boil down to three main ideas, all confirmed by testimonies of other authors. The divinization of their leader, Martabash Duratsutyunen, which literally translates as man worship, the rejection of the church ritual and hierarchy, and the notion that the body of Jesus was not of human nature, but existed before the creation in its divinity. Let us now zoom out and see how these ideas fit within the larger picture of heretical movements in the Near East of the time. All three teachings constitute the landmark doctrines of a group of heretics called by Muslim heresiographers extremist Shi'is, Ghulat, for their extreme reverence to their leaders, the Imams, and these extremists lived in the 9th, 8th centuries Iraq. Now, who were these Ghulat? Let me give you a small historical background. In the history of early Islam, the 8th century was the time of the emergence of a distinct Shi'i religious identity. It was mainly centered on the idea of the divinely bestowed right of some representatives of the Prophet Muhammad's family, the Imams, to be leaders of the Islamic community. This basic teaching found numerous modifications and interpretations among the Shi'is, some of which later acquired the status of religious orthodoxy, while others gradually pushed to the margins of the religious mainstream were branded as heterodox and heretical. Now, one of the chief disagreements between various factions within Shi'ism was the nature of the Imam, the religious leader and descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. While part of the Shi'is viewed the Imams as merely learned men, who, due to their knowledge, could be the community's spiritual guides, another saw them as divinely inspired superhuman beings, or even God's manifestations in human flesh. So these are the two main factions. As a reflection of their theological differences, the two groups named each other respectively Muqassira, that is, moderates or those who fall short of recognizing the Imam's true nature, and Ghulat, the plural of Ghalin, which means extremists, that is, who take their devotion to the Imams to the extreme. The two groups were, of course, by no means homogeneous theological entities, and along with the general orientation toward the Imam's nature, included numerous other beliefs. The extremists, for example, believed in the transmigration of souls, tanasukh, the transformation of humans into subhuman forms, masakh, masukhiyya, the idea of God's manifestation in human flesh, hulul, and the notion that humans could in their turn attain to the divine realm, becoming free of the formal religious duties. Now, despite the theological differences, the two factions were not distinct socially, and in the 8th century, representatives of the Ghulat freely mixed with their theological opponents, while the Imams had followers from both camps. Tension did exist, of course, and the excessive veneration of some of the extremists could at times cause the Imams a great deal of headache and anxiety. leading them to curse or banish some of their most fervent followers, probably out of fear of the persecution by the caliphal government, who would tell them, accuse them of divinizing themselves. Early in the 8th century, several powerful rebellions broke out on the territory of Iraq, mainly centered in the main Shi'i stronghold, the town of Kufa, led by charismatic leaders who often claimed divinity for the Shi'i imams. So here is the town of Kufa. While reserving for themselves the role of the divine imam's prophet. Some even went as far as later to claim divinity for themselves. The best-known Ghulat movement of the 8th century, for example, was called Al-Khattabiyya, named after its leader Abu al-Khattab al-Asadi. Her historiographer al-Baghdadi tells us that that first he taught that the imams were prophets, but afterwards stated that they were gods. He also held that Ja'far was the incarnation of God, who appointed him as his legatee, wasi, telling him God's greatest name. His followers are said to have been antinomians, that is, the people who cancelled religious duties and allowed the forbidden. Apparently, Ja'far first tolerated his presence in his environment, but when Abu al-Khattab went too far, the imam cursed him and banned him from his environment. Around the year 755, the Khattabiyya rebelled in Kufa, but were defeated by the governor and put to death along with their leader. After the defeat of the Ghulat uprisings, their political activity seems to have ceased alongside their messianic fervor. But the Ghulat remained an integral part of the Shi'i community of the time throughout the 8th and 9th centuries. There were numerous individuals professing ideas termed as ghulu, that is, the teaching of Ghulat by extremism, by later authors, but this did not prevent at least some of them from mixing with other Shi'is and from being close to the imams themselves. During the 9th century, the tensions exacerbated as each group was trying to overcome their opponents. The extremists were promoting their ideas by spreading their literature among the Shi'i community, while the moderates tried to discredit them by declaring their teachings unbelief. All the while, these Ghulat were producing religious literature which was largely kept secret and circulated among the members of the group. Most of it perished, while a large chunk was transported by the survivors of the Ghulat, the Nusayris, to Syria in the 10th century. Now, the Nusayris are the direct descendants of the Ghulat, who emerged in Syria in the 10th century, and in the 20th century they took the name of Alawites. So the Assad family are actually the descendants of the people who I'm talking about. It remained unknown to the larger Islamic tradition for several centuries, and only in the 19th did snippets of it begin to come to light due to the efforts of French Orientalists. The paucity of original Ghulat texts has to this day been the main obstacle in understanding their worldview. The reports of the heresiographers have been often viewed as polemically skewed, while historical works contain only small fragments of their teachings, largely focusing on their political activity. Only three original treatises written by Ghulat authors were published during the 20th century. A better understanding of the Ghulat worldview became possible with the publication of a large corpus of Nusayri authors in the first decade of the 21st century. What makes these texts valuable for the study of early Shi'i extremism is that many of them are full of quotations from early Ghulat writings. These, together with a treatise surviving in manuscript, make a sizable corpus of Ghulat literature, allowing for a reconstruction of their main teachings. And these teachings do contain some surprising parallel to the doctrines of the Tondra clans. Let us begin with the first point, namely, the idea of the divinization of their leaders, or leader, and the idea that God can become man, and man can become God. The 10th accusation of Gregory of Narek, leveled against the Tondrakians, is this. Martapasht uratsutyun en vor garshelie yev anitsial kanes karapashtutyun. Their anthropolatrous apostasy, man worship, more abominable and cursed than idolatry. And the 14th point of the same author is Zgalchavor aghandin yurian handgnyal Christos anvaren. They dare to call the head of their abominable sect Christ. In keeping with the same idea, I'm sorry. Interestingly, the Amir who killed the founder of the movement, Sambat, allegedly said, "Since you call yourself a Christ, and Christ rose on the third day, I will slay you and bury you, and if you rise even on the 30th day, I will believe that you are Christ." And he didn't rise, apparently. Now, the idea of a divine or semi-divine man who partakes in some of God's functions is known from antiquity, exemplified in the image of the Platonic and then the Gnostic Demiurge, who created the world on his behalf or despite him. And one may be justified in seeking the roots of this belief of the Armenian heretics precisely here, among the Platonists and Gnostics. But rather than looking for elusive roots of various religious ideas, looking at a larger contemporary context is a more fruitful approach, as it is more verifiable by looking at connections between regions. Among Muslim heretics of the same period, the divinization of the Shi'i imams and sometimes of their religious leaders was one of the main ideas that made the Khulat stand out from other early Muslims, and which so much shocked and outraged later Muslim heresiographers writing about them. While some modern scholars have viewed this idea as a heresiographic invention, that is, the Khulat didn't really believe in these ideas, but heresiographers attributed it to them, there is ample evidence in the original Khulat writings confirming that they did divinize certain individuals. In fact, there is a variety of ways the Khulat imagined this idea. One was the notion that God can descend upon earth in human guise in order to become perceived by them, because he is unknowable otherwise. So the Khulat universe revolved around the notion of the so-called great chain of being, where the entire entire world formed a hierarchical ladder, stretching from an ineffable and unknowable God down to the world of humans and down still to the world of animals, plants, and inanimate objects. Man, who combined the divine soul and the human body, stood at the center of this hierarchy, conjoining the luminous world of spiritual beings and the dark world of matter. In order to become known to humans, God would at times assume human form and descend upon earth to instruct them and lead them to the right path. Second, many Khulat texts emphasize that throughout history, God became manifest in the material world in the form of biblical patriarchs, Shi'i imams, and the Prophet Muhammad. There were several varieties of this doctrine among them. A group called Mukhammisa, from the Arabic root khamasa for five, believed that God became manifest in Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad, his son Ali, Ali's wife, and Muhammad's daughter Fatima, and Muhammad's grandchildren through these two, Hassan and Hussein. A variety of this belief was espoused by the Aliyaiya, for whom God became incarnate in the same five, but here Ali was the main incarnation and Muhammad was subordinate to him. Another version was the teaching of the delegators, the so-called Mufawwida, from the Arabic root Fawada, to delegate someone to do something on your behalf, who believed that God delegated the creation or care for the world to certain human individuals. And this idea is attested throughout the 8th to the end of the 10th century in various Khulat texts. The author of a certain Kitab al-Tanbih says that Muhammad is the creator of things. He is God's servant, listening and obedient to him. He created him unlike he created men, but he created him from light. So it's really surprising that to hear that Muhammad is the creator, but he is God's servant, which to Muslim heresiographers was total unbelief. In another work titled Kitab al-Adilla, Muhammad is the first created thing to whom God delegated the affairs of the world. Now, just as God could descend upon earth in human form, so due to effort, man could ascend the spiritual ladder and become like God, or almost equal to God. The hierarchical chain stretching from man to God, according to the Khulat, consisted of a path, sirat, of seven consecutive degrees of spiritual perfection, which a believer could traverse through piety and by acquiring the knowledge of God's oneness, unity, tawheed. Having reached the seventh degree, the believer becomes an angel and acquires supernatural abilities. He can become invisible, can disappear, and nothing can be concealed from him. He finds whatever he desires without the need to seek, sees without having to be shown, and hears without having to listen. He can even see and hear God. The believer at this stage becomes free of the duty to worship, kharaja anit ta'abbud, acquires freedom of choice and knows without the necessity to be taught. Of course, man could also descend into the world of animals, plants, and minerals for his sins through rebirth into lower forms of existence. But that doesn't concern us here. This brings us to the second accusation against the Tondrakans, namely the rejection of the church hierarchy and ritual. And in his accusation of the Tondrakians, Gregory Magistros writes, according to him, the Tondrakians claim, "We are no worshippers of matter, but of God. We reckon the cross and the church and the priestly robes and the sacrifice of mass all for nothing, and only lay stress on their inner meaning." Interestingly, this idea of inner meaning, inner sense, inner batin, is very important in among these very Muslim heretics. Another point by the same author, "And again, they deny the sacrifice of Christ and do not allow it to be offered for those who believed in Christ and have fallen asleep." And lastly, Magistros says, "It is notorious that they wander about without bishops and without priests." Turning to the Muslim heretics, we see that one of the staple accusations that heresiographers level against them is called Ibaha, or antinomianism, that is the abolition of religious laws. One of the best known Ghulat sources, Kitab al-Sirat, confirms this by saying that when a believer comes to the end of the spiritual path, the external zahir acts of worship become unnecessary. If he reaches them and knows them station after station and degree after degree, he will become free. Or the servitude of God will become unnecessary for him, and he will leave the state of being owned for the state of being free by reaching the end of the spiritual quest and by his knowledge. Of course, the Ghulats believe in the redundancy of religious acts of worship mentioned above could be a theological abstraction, and we do not know to what degree they really used or implemented this or followed this in real life. But there are more direct references to the effect that they had a much more practical approach to this, in keeping with what the Armenian heretics were accused of. Briefly stated, it is the idea that all religious obligations and taboos are persons or names of persons, and that worship is simply knowing these persons. The above-mentioned Khattabiyya, for example, are accused of, quote, "naming all religious duties after certain men and doing the same with vile acts." In a letter to the same Abul Khattab, the leader of the Khattabiyya, the sixth Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq tells them, "It has to come to my attention that you claim that fornication, zina, is a man, that wine, khamr, is a man, that fasting is a man, and that the abominations, fawahish, are a man." 10th century heresiographer Al-Ash'ari attributes the same belief to another extremist, Abul Khattab's contemporary Abu Mansur al-Ijli, who allegedly claimed that paradise is a man and hellfire is a man. Original Ghulat writings amply confirm this teaching. For example, in one place Ja'far al-Sadiq tells one of his followers that prayer is Ali, alms is the knowledge of him, and performing prayer is knowing and performing us, that is the imams. Which means you don't really have to pray like other Muslims do. It further elaborates that in religious duties, bodily movements do not matter, but rather the inner batin aspect does, and that mentioning one's Lord means praying, actually. The notion that, in Gregory Magistros' words, the Tondrakians reckon the cross and the church and the priestly robes and the sacrifice of mass, that is all religious symbols and rituals, all for nothing, and only lay stress on their inner sense, is also attested in Ghulat literature. There is even an entire book written by a certain Ishaq al-Ahmar toward the end of the 9th century, soon after the emergence of the Armenian heresy, which is called on the inner meaning of religious obligations, Kitab Batin al-Taklif, which is entirely dedicated to explaining the true, that is inner, batin, meaning of religious obligations, taklif. Its author says that the knowledge of Ali and uttering Muhammad's name with a truthful utterance, bi haqiqat al-dhikr, equal prayer, and the inner meaning of almsgiving is the knowledge of the imams. Ishaq also equates different parts of the Kaaba with members of the Prophet's family, and the five Islamic prayers with the Prophet Muhammad, his son-in-law and daughter, Imam Ali and Fatima, and his grandsons, Hassan and Hussein. All the remaining works of the Ghulat corpus discussing this idea are simply too numerous to be mentioned here. Let's go to the third doctrinal point that connects the Tondrakians to a larger Near Eastern religious milieu, and this is the belief that the body of our Lord was not of human nature, but existed before the creation of man in eternity, in his divinity. Մարմինը տեառն մերո եթե ոչ էր իբնութենե մարդկան, այլ հառաչ քանզ լինելություն մարդուին, եւ նախքանս հավիտյանս ընտասվածության յուրում. According to Nerses, this is the belief of the accursed Eutychites and other ancient Christian heretics. Now, Eutychus, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, the founder of Eutychianism, who taught that Christ's humanity was united with his divinity, forming one single divine nature, lived 400 years before Sambat in Constantinople. Whereas a similar belief has been attested in the teachings of our Muslim heretics, who lived almost contemporaneously with the Tondrakians, 8th, 9th centuries, and at a much, much closer distance in central Iraq. Of course, instead of Jesus, their ideas centered around the Imams and the Prophet Muhammad, but they are surprisingly similar. The ideas about the so-called pre-existence of the Imams initially circulated among the Shi'i extremists, but they found their way, interestingly, into the canonical 12er Shi'i hadith corpus and have thus survived to this day and are widely known. The gist of the belief is that the Imams and sometimes the Prophet Muhammad were created before the rest of humanity in the form of luminous shadows, adilla, or phantoms, ashbah. A number of traditions tell that the Imams were shadows of light before all else was created, praising and extolling the Almighty. According to a saying attributed to Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq from one of the main canonical collections of Shia hadith from Kulaini's Al-Kafi, we, that is the Imams, were near our Lord with no one else near him in a green tent, praising, worshipping, glorifying and extolling him, with no angel and no living being apart from us nearby, until he decided to create the things, and he created whatever he wished and however he wished, angels and others, then gave the knowledge of that to us. And again, Ja'far says that before anything was created, we, that is the Imams, were shadows of light, ashbah nur, around the throne, praising God 15,000 years before he would create Adam. Then we entered his loins and were thus transmitted until we reached Muhammad Ali and his family. Note that just like in the case of the Tondrakians, they existed before the creation of the world, 15,000 years actually. And his saying attributed to Ja'far's father, Muhammad al-Baqir, we, that is the Imams, were light near God before he had created the creation. Qablan yakhluq al-khalq, as he puts it. Now, the notion of the pre-existence of the Imams and the Prophet in the Shi'i hadith corpus has been thoroughly analyzed by French-Iranian scholar Muhammad Ali Amir Muazzi, according to whom this was one of the trademarks of early, as he calls it, esoteric Shi'ism. In some of the traditions which he analyzes, the Prophet and Ali were created together from the same light. Several thousand years before the creation of the world, the former representing the external, zahir, aspect of religion, and the latter the esoteric, batin. The idea of a luminous being who, like Jesus, partakes in God's divinity, yet is apart from him, is discussed in several writings from the original Ghulat corpus, which were considered lost. For example, according to one story, the first thing that God created from his will was a shadow of Ili, which he made after his own image. He then divided it into numerous shadows of Illah. Then he praised himself, and they praised him for several thousand years. From their praise, God created the highest veil, hijab. That's an important point. One of the human forms that he assumed to appear to his creation, in a way similar to Jesus. And the phantoms, Ashbah. This is followed by the creation of the world, comprising the seven heavens, seven Adams, the progeny of each of these Adams, and concluded with the creation of devils from the transgressions of believers. Note that the shadow that existed before creation ultimately becomes that into which God is incarnated in order to appear to the humanity, akin to the Christian idea of God made flesh. Finally, in the 12th century, Muslim heresiographer Al-Shahrastani wrote that the Ishaqis, followers of the mentioned Ishaq al-Ahmar and Nusayris, believed that the Imams were shadows at the right hand of God's throne before the creation. Now, having discussed the similarities and possible affinities between the teachings of the Tondrakians and their near contemporary extremist Shi'is, let me go back to a point mentioned at the very beginning of this presentation, namely the possible connections between the Armenian heretics and that and what Muslim heresiographers have called Khurramites or Khurramis. Some of the authors who worked on Tondrakians that I mentioned earlier have noted the possible ties between them and the movement of Babak, one of the main leaders of Khurramis. However, their discussion has only focused on this particular leader and has missed the entire spectrum of other similar movements that sprang on the territory of Iran from Azerbaijan to Khurasan during the 8th to 9th centuries. And this is the map of their uprisings. The Khurrami movements, which are analyzed in a brilliant recent study by Patricia Crone, were popular uprisings led by charismatic leaders who taught a blend of Islamic and Zoroastrian doctrines. In West Iran, one of the earliest such revolts was that of Sumbad in mid-8th century, followed by the Abu Muslimiyya, which centered on the martyr image of the murdered leader of the Abbasid revolution, Abu Muslim al-Khurasani. Closer to the Armenian territories was the revolt of the mentioned Babak, which took place in 816 in Azerbaijan. In his rebellion, Babak tried to enlist the help of Armenian princes, but because of his indiscriminate killings, they turned away from him, and after his defeat by the Caliphal army, he was handed to the Caliph by an Armenian noble. In the mid-8th century, Abdullah ibn Muawiyah rebelled in western Iran and conquered a vast territory stretching from Kufa to Iraq to Fars. Kufa in Iraq to Fars. But he was also eventually defeated and put to death. Further to the east, the Muhammira, the red-clothed ones, rebelled in Jurjan and the Khidashiya in Marv. Finally, toward the end of the 8th century, a group of Khurramis called Al-Mubayyida, the white-clothed ones, rebelled in Khurasan under the leadership of the so-called Al-Muqanna, the veiled one, because he veiled his face, allegedly. Almost all of the Khurramis shared two of the fundamental ideas espoused by the Tondrakians and by the Ghulat: God's manifestation in human flesh, which chiefly included their leaders, as well as the Shia Imams and the Prophet Muhammad, and the redundancy of formal acts of worship. Like the Ghulat, they used the term tanasukh, reincarnation, or hulul, descending, to denote the transfer of God's spirit through a chain of prophets and imams into some of their leaders. One of the most detailed accounts of Khurrami beliefs is 10th century Ismaili heresiographer Abu Tammam's description of the teachings of the Mubayyida Khurramis, one of the groups that I mentioned. Okay. According to him, they believe that all the messenger prophets are gods whose bodies are messengers of God and whose spirits are God himself. Whenever God wants to speak to bodily creatures, he enters the form of one of them and makes it to be a messenger to them, commanding them to do what he desires and intends, or prohibiting them from what he does not want. According to Abu Tammam, the Mubayyida believed in a chain of divine incarnations beginning with Adam and including Jesus, Muhammad, Abraham, and ending with Al-Muqanna himself. A similar belief has been attested for the followers of another Khurram believer, Abdullah ibn al-Muawiyah, who taught that God's spirit was incarnated in Adam and then passed through the line of prophets into him. Regarding the abolition of religious law, Abu Tamam reports that, like the Ghulat, they taught that prohibitions and duties are merely names of men, and that knowing these men suffices for one to be a believer. Likewise, they have abolished the religious obligations and claim that they too are names of men whose leadership God required. The Khidashiya and Abu Muslimiya likewise taught that knowing the Imam freed one of the necessity to perform formal acts of worship. So basically, these two beliefs were pretty much universally shared by all Khurramis. There is one final point that I would like to highlight that unites all of the mentioned heretics, or rather, unites how they are represented by outside accounts writing about them. Namely, the accusation of in lecherous promiscuity, to use Gregory of Narek's words, and their denial of the sacrament of marriage. Now, when you look at any heresiographic account, probably from any religious tradition, the accusation of promiscuity is going to be one of the gravest ones that you will find. And this is true not only for Christian heresies like the Tondrakians, but very true of the above-mentioned Ghulat and Khurramis. Virtually every Muslim heresiographic account accuses the Ghulat and Khurramis of being sexually promiscuous, being homosexuals, drinking wine, eating pork and carrion. To what extent is this true? Of course, one is tempted to brush these accusations aside as polemical devices to smear one's opponents. And because in some cases, as with the Tondrakians, such movements often leave no surviving works of their own, it is impossible to verify to the extent to which these accusations might be true. Nonetheless, I would like to make several points. First of all, we saw that the accusations of the abolition of formal religious duties were indeed true, if rather schematic. The Ghulat themselves wrote about the idea that one can become free of the formal duties, formal religious duties, just as the heresiographers accused them. Secondly, original Ghulat writings do contain vague echoes of both polemics against such accusations and confirmations that some of them might have truth in them. For example, Kitab al-Hafd's author, one of the main best-known Ghulat primary sources, dedicates an entire chapter arguing that homosexuality is, quote, an illness which never befalls a true believer, and that homosexuals are those who in their previous lives have been promiscuous women. Now, this is clearly directed against the accusations of heresiographers against the Ghulat. However, another author, Ishaq al-Ahmar, whom I mentioned, late 9th century, in his Kitab al-Sirat says that there are two aspects of homosexual intercourse, a praiseworthy one and a blameworthy one, Mahmud wa Madhmum. We don't know what the blameworthy one is because the passage is corrupt, but the praiseworthy one is this. It is, according to him, akin like the transfer of knowledge from teacher to student. And there are several similar discussions in the literature of Nusayris, who, as I mentioned, were the direct descendants of the Ghulat in terms of religious teachings. Whether this is an allegory simply likening intercourse to the transfer of knowledge or a description of real relationships between teacher and disciple, we may not know at this stage. Even less do we know about the same aspect of Tondrakians, who unfortunately have left no writings of their own. And the only way to remedy this would be a miraculous discovery of their original writings. In any case, it has to be noted that even when accusations in libertinism have some truth to them, the reality usually, when you look at the primary texts written by the people themselves, the reality is much more nuanced than described by historiographers. Let me now move beyond the doctrinal points uniting the Armenian heretics, the Shi'i extremists, and the Khurramis, and discuss the religio-cultural milieu that made it possible for a common vocabulary of symbols and ideas to unite ostensibly disparate religious traditions. Since very early on, the Armenian mainland was closely tied to the world that was stretching to its south and southeast, that is Mesopotamia and the Iranian plateau. Once part of the Achaemenid Empire, Armenia continued to be under a heavy political and cultural influence of Iran for centuries to come. Armenian kingdoms were influenced politically and culturally by the Arsacids, by the Arsacid dynasty and the Sasanian dynasty after them. Hence, for example, the large number of Middle Iranian borrowings in Armenian, which have survived to this day, mainly in the fields of administration, military terminology, and jurisprudence. After the emergence of Islam, Armenia remained closely connected with this region. Arabs began making inroads here as early as the 40s of the 7th century, and toward the end of the same century, Armenia was officially made part of the Caliphate. In the period of Muslim domination, Armenia was very closely connected with the Caliphate economically, as well as culturally and socially. For example, it was a major supplier of gold, silver, textiles such as wool and silk, timber, and other commodities. For example, around the year 785, Armenia supplied 13 million dirhams worth of textiles, carpets, mules, and salted fish, which is a huge sum. For comparison, the same amounts worth was collected from the entire region of Ifriqiya. Armenia was at the crossroads of several major trade routes connecting Mesopotamia, Egypt, Iran, North Caspian regions, and Central Asia. Maurice Lombard speaks of a considerable Armenian trading community that moved to Mesopotamia and established their center in Baghdad. To conclude, during the 9th century, when the described events were taking place, Armenia had long been in the orbit of the Iranian and then Arab Muslim cultural influence, taking part in a lively exchange in goods, but also in exchange in men and ideas with the larger Near East of the time. It was part of a connected late antique world, which, to use the words of the late Thomas Szigorich, had an established lexicon of signs, symbols, narratives, and associations that might be described as essentially late antique. And it was this semiotic brew that united a constellation of communities otherwise separated by language, culture, and dogma across a geographic expanse stretching from Ireland to Yemen. Thank you.